that his sister's on, you did ask him, and I think it's because he's so full of the topic that he's going to talk to you about that he's just glad of any chance to talk about it. Most of us are content if we master one little part of one subject in the scriptures, and Lee has certainly done that, but I noticed sometime after not too long after I first met him, that his name also appeared in the poster staff and the book reviews. And there weren't books in Old Testament, they were books in literature and art and film. And that's the kind of thing he's going to bring together for us in some way today, biblical faith and film.
You'll recall Emerson's comment that certain skills are signs of a misspent youth. Now, the reason I didn't have to have my arms twisted on it was simply that I need to test some ideas and find out whether or not they hold up. And this is a working paper, and it's a hypothesis. And since it's been voiced mostly among people whom I do a good deal of dialoguing with, I'm not really sure how good it holds up in a larger community. So I don't think I feel too defensive about what's here. It is a working paper, and I'm going to indicate at a number of points where I have some lack of resolution or some questions, and if you've got suggestions down there, I would appreciate it. Even give me a sabbatical next fall to work in the area of biblical faith and film. As a title, the interplay of biblical faith, film, and contemporary experience. And I've got the traditional introduction to a paper here, but what it largely says is that in terms of my own autobiography, I found that the tradition, whether expressed theologically or biblically, had become such an old story to me that it had lost a compelling power. And I found myself going through motions, whether it was the motions of going to sleep, listening to preaching, or of the Eucharist losing its bite and its power, or simply talking about the Bible as an object, dissecting it like a cat in the laboratory, and losing the live sense of grace and vitality that makes up catnip, the difference between the cat in the laboratory and the cat in the Japanese stream. I also had a parallel experience that a great many people with whom I dialogue are people who are in general above average in intelligence, whether lay people or students. It's a selected group educationally. And that they also have problems buying into the faith in terms of volition or experience. They know the words like a broken record. They know the concept, but they exist either in their mind or frequently in TA terms, they operate in the mind like a demanding parent rather than giving rise to any kind of natural child and experience of wonder or idleness. Part of this, I think, is symbolized in what may be a great divide, the rise of radical theology with the problems it gives to speaking the language of faith. So I'm operating with some assumptions. One assumption is my belief that all experience, here I'm talking specifically about film, but equally in terms of literature, art, teaching, counseling, autobiography, that all experience is potentially and perhaps actually religious. That is, experience always has the potential of being the realm of the holy, of being sacramental. Another one belief is the conviction that the shape of human experience is perceived as having the shape of five or perhaps six basic mythic patterns. And I want to talk about that in respect to film. And also I find this a very slippery, elusive kind of thing to deal with. And since I've probably seen more movies than you have, and how do I communicate to you what happens in the movies that I've seen, when they're not applied to experience, it's going to be a kind of a slippery process, partly because I wish to fuse myths and history and religion and theology and culture, and also because of cultural contamination or syncretism, that the examples in film are made up of a composite of forces bringing to bear upon them. And so a few examples taken from film will be pure examples of biblical material. Well, with that behind, what I'd like to do is six areas. First, pick up some concrete details or images or episodes in film and relate them to some specific passages. And probably to test out with you, because I don't know, are these parallels significant enough to mention, or is it simply another preacher trying to buttress his text with some sermon illustration? I hope that there is a deeper relationship. Secondly, I want to talk about the experience of presence, or shekinah, in the experience of film. And thirdly, I want to talk about the experience of covenantal relationships in the experience of film. And fourth, I want to raise the issue of cosmology, which I think needs to be raised, but I don't know how to resolve it. And fifth, I want to talk about the five or the six myths and illustrate them with film. And sixth, I want to ask, for what? I think I shall do this by simply giving very limited illustration and using one film to do my work, basically, although I have listed here numerous other examples. Where my examples are kind of thin, and I think my argument is thin, I won't pound and shout, but I'll be quite open with you that here I find the ice thin, and hope that you'll extend me a ladder. First of all, filming biblical faith, we have some parallelism of individual details. And I'm dealing here with implicit parallelism. I'd understand explicit parallelism would be like the film The Ruling Class at the Fine Arts Theater now, where the character simply says, "I'm Jesus Christ." That's pretty explicit. There's nothing ambiguous about it. But the parallels that are implicit are where the relationship seems to me to be real, but the connection is not explicitly made. For example, the kind of thing that you have in Mark 2, 21 and 22 was a comment made about the new and the old cloth being sown, or the new wine and the old and new wine skin. The opening of the film Passion of Anna by Bergman shows a weather-beaten shed, a man on the roof packing it, and a cold, hard wind blowing, and it's a picture of absolute bleakness and of grayness. And my feeling is that what one is getting here is patching some old cloth or filling some old wine skin, and that the metaphor has some points of resemblance. Resemblance may be that of antithesis. Namely, that there is no new wine being offered in this particular context. The film Ruling Class, which stars Peter O'Toole as a paranoid schizophrenic, who in the first half of the film regards himself as being Jesus Christ in the Second Coming and acts accordingly. The result is, of course, that nobody believes him. Everybody treats him as though he were mad, including the members of his own family. He has the most naive belief about love being real and ultimate. He suffers crucifixion and betrayal and so on. Speaks in the first person. I bless this food to our youth, and I bless you with it, this sort of thing. And then followed by a transition in which he moves from being white clothes to being dressed in black, and he now takes, instead of being J.C., He takes on his birth name of Jack and takes on the epithet not of Christ but of Jack the Ripper, and proceeds then in a rip-off of repression and of order imposed by power. It sounds very much to me, first of all, in the Christ motif by 1 Corinthians 1:23, where Jesus Christ presented is a standalone, a stumbling block to Jews, to rational people, and foolishness to Gentiles, like me. And also, moving into the area of first resurrection for millennium and the dominion of Satan for millennium in Revelation 20, and suggesting some real motifs about how power is handed over and what happens in it. A fourth area comes from the film Deliverance. You recall in 1 Samuel 25 where Abigail comes to David in a very eloquent speech, among other things, says that we are all bound up together in the bundle of the living. You saw Deliverance, you remember the scene where after he has shot with a bow and arrow the mountaineer and is bringing the body down on a rope, that the rope frays and breaks and they plunge into the pool, and the rope winds itself around the two like an umbilical cord, and they are bound together, and underneath the water in the abyss or the womb into which they've been hurled, the corpse does a kind of a dance of death as it embraces the man who has killed it. And it's an extraordinary emblem which seems to have some parallels. I would think it'd be rather easy to construct a psychology which would see the Godfather and the unscrupulous steward of Luke 16 really talking about how business is business and the sons of this world are wiser than the sons of the kingdom. If nothing else, it's including the kingdom of the Godfather, in which you see the subservient role of the church to the carrying on of business. Now, I think these are legitimate parallels, because I think they are describing common realities, common mythic, common emblems of where it's the same reality perceived in a parallel of symbolism or imagery. And I think there is congruency of the elements being compared. I need to be checked on this as to whether or not these parallels are forced or free moving, but they seem to me to be genuinely congruent. Is there significance here? I do not know, because I really don't have enough data, and I haven't really started working with details. I've been working with sweeping patterns. And I would like to think it's significant, but I don't know. One thing it seems to me that may be significant here is that a kind of parable like the unjust steward that really throws modern people. I may perhaps receive some illumination if you explain it in terms of the Godfather and then come back to the unjust steward. And really, this paper is an exercise in hermeneutics and the problems of communication of tradition to contemporary man. And if it moves effectively in this direction, then there may be value here. First, then, the parallelism of detail between parts of the Bible and parts of film. Secondly, the experience of Shekinah. If film experience is fairly covenantal, and I want to move to that in a few minutes, and if in the film there is an existential opening of the self, that is, there is the film serves as a mediation to bring about an encounter between the self and what is real, an opening of the self to the cruciality of experience, that the stakes are life and death, then it seems to me possible that an experience of the presence, or like the prophet Ezekiel, or of the absence of the presence, the Shekinah, may take place. But the impact of a film may be that the dwelling of God is with men. Now, the impact of a film may be that the dwelling of God is not with men and testify to the absence of God. What we're talking about again is on an implicit level rather than an explicit level, or a typological level, is the same kind of pattern of experience being mediated by a film that can take place within the religious cult or took place in ancient Israel or the New Testament church. Let me give some examples of what I mean. About 10 years ago, I saw the film La Ventura by Antonioni, the man who did Lord and Sabrisky Point. And it was a film that I knew was an art film and an excellent film, which I wanted to see. I've been carrying a typically overloaded schedule, which is simply the work obsession of the Protestant ethic rather than healthy living. And I went knowing that, first of all, that it was the kind of film that depresses my wife, and she didn't want to go, knowing also she did not want me to go. The question here of law, if you're damned, if you go, and damned if you don't go. There's no justification by this kind of activity. So I went. This is not a battle. This is one of these wordless silences I think we need to have. The film dealt with, it's very similar to La Dolce Vita, if you know the famous film. It dealt with with the decline of an architect as he becomes more and more corrupt by the decadence of aristocratic living. He picks up a casual relationship in which the girl becomes more and more committed to him, in which he remains pretty much as he is. When they are together one night, he leaves her and has a casual relationship with a girl on a sofa in a hotel where she discovers him. Morning breaks, it's a gray morning. He's on a gravel patio. He's facing a geometric blank wall, a gray sky, a distant horizon. Nothing is moving. He's just simply sitting with his back to the camera. And the girl comes out, stands behind him, motionless for a while, and a very, very slow movement of her hand by which she reaches out and touches him on the shoulder, and he turns and looks at her and then turns back, and the hand comes down. It's ambiguous. It's something you've seen Shepherd's Peace, which is in town now. It's a similar kind of ambiguity. You don't know whether these two people are permanently estranged or whether this is an act of reconciliation and there's a potential the relationship will be restored. Symbols frequently have this kind of ambiguity as to whether they're positive or negative. What I'm concerned about here, though, is Katrina. I saw the film and came back, and the next morning when I got up, there was a presence in my existence. As I had seen the film the night before, I began to remember. There was a feeling that went through me, a kind of perspective about who I was in relationship to my wife. And there was a kind of a film hangover for a week or 10 days, in which the aura of what had happened to me that night in that enclosed dark space. And you perhaps can tell, as I am saying this to you now, 10 years later, that I'm talking about something which has some truth reality to me, which has a presence as of this moment. And something happened. Something which rarely, if ever, happens to me in preaching, although it does happen to me in the sacrament. Or, not quite as dramatic, if you know the film by Bergman, Through a Glass Darkly, in which a girl becomes a schizophrenic, where God is revealed to her as a monstrous spider devouring her, which is a pretty good way of describing the way the environment has treated her, an environment of husband, father, and brother. And then a scene when she's in trauma, when she is brought down the stairs, and the family is grouped, like the Rubens painting of the Descent from the Cross. And she's borne away in the sky to the hospital by helicopter. The father and son are at the window looking out over the Scandinavian Sea. They live on an island, which is one of the symbols that Bergman uses. And the father and son, who really have not been able to communicate to one another. The father, when he goes away on trips, brings back for his son the kind of gift he used to bring for him when he was 4 and 5 years old. Now he's 17 and 18. And then the father begins to talk about love. Very stammeringly, very hesitantly, and only a sentence or two. And there's a pause, and then the son says, Daddy spoke to me. And to be in the presence of this sequence of experiences left me with an experience of presence. Another Bergman film is called Silence, in which apparently a mother and son, they're never designated, arrive to visit a sister in a hotel with a few human freaks in it, with the sound of tanks in the streets below and a deserted urban state. Nobody is able to have relationships with one another. The relationships that they have are the self-love of one sister and the promiscuous love of the other sister. And the film ends on an elevated railroad with the boy and the woman, who apparently is his mother. And the boy is standing at the window looking over the city where it's raining and there's steam on it, and he's making drawings in it. And he simply says very quietly, and you can barely hear it, and most people don't hear it, "Serious." And it does something serious. I think these kinds of experience are akin to the cultic, the encounter, to what they mean by sasina. It can happen in a negative way, in Separate Teeth, for example, the movie that deals with two adolescents in the 1940s, we're living the separate, peaceful life of a school while the world is at war, who are in a love-hate relationship of competition with one another, which results in the death of one and the ongoing of another, who are involved in a world without adults, whose communities are communities of individuals, but not of love. We saw this last night with a group of high school sophomores, and one of the girls said to the man driving us, he said, "But there's no family here." And the particular group of young people that she's associated with, they regard their youth group as an extended family. And the piece is made for each one in this film separately. And you start to play around with Paul Tillich's description of sin as separation and alienation. This description of reality as a denial of community is a pretty staggering thing. Or in a movie such as The Graduate of several years ago, the kind of portrait that emerges of the church, and particularly the closing scene where it looks as though love has triumphed over everything, and you see the exaltation at winning a victory and the ecstasy of being together, and all of a sudden the deadpan face, and you are permitted to read the future, that these young people 25 years from now will be in the same classic age as their parents. And one has a sense of absence. Or in The Ruling Class, the film which you might describe this J.C. with his flower culture and so on, this English earl believing himself the incarnation, as a kind of 19th century optimism and idealism, succeeded then in Jack the Ripper as a description of the exploitation made by a capitalistic and oppressive society. And the final scenes are presented in terms of the House of Lords that you see, first of all, in their brilliant red regalia, and then as cobweb-covered skeletons. And it ends. And I think it's permissible to see some parallels between this understanding of an imposed law and order that wishes to restore, say, capital punishment, to keep people in their place, to establish the law and order of the people who merit the protection of law and order, some real significant parallels with American culture, in which case then it becomes pretty chilling, and one feels the absence of the subpoena in our midst. So, this biblical faith is about the presence of God with us, and in terms of situations of judgment, the removal of the presence of God with us, I see some parallels between biblical experience and film experience. The third area is in that of covenantal, contractual treaty. The covenantal aspect of the film as experience, both in the sense of the film as covenant making, and also the experience of the film as covenant lawsuit. One of the youth last night said, "Well, there goes $2.25, which I would understand to be covenant lawsuit language. He just thought he was going to get $2.25 worth, and he didn't. And there's something wrong. It's a miniature job." Well, try this on and see what happens. The encounter takes place at the cultic sanctuary, which in this case is not Shechem, but the Bijou. First of all, the parties involved are clearly designated. There is the eye of the individual, and film going is usually done in some form of community, a couple dating, a dinner party by a couple of couples who've gone out for an evening, a group of people socializing. The community that is established and comes into being was a cultic event of the screening of the film. A community that did not exist until the encounter took place in the film event. There is the party on the one hand, and then on the other, the vow of the reality of the film itself and its mediators. The director and others who caused it to come into being, that's probably far enough. There is a sense in which if the film deals with a revelation of reality, a revelation of God and God's ways, then the director and the actors are very much like the friends of Job. If you read Job as a statement of covenant and a covenant lawsuit, the friends of Job mediate for God to justify God's way to Job. In this sense, the director and the film, the actors, have produced a reality of the film which purports to tell it like it is, like the friends of Job. So you have the parties who are involved in a relationship. And the relationship is either possible or impossible because they share a common historical recital. That is, the appeal of a film depends upon the history of the people who are viewing it, or upon the cultural history at the point in time in which it's being shown. The movie made in the 30s about marijuana, was it Richard Holliday? Now showing at the Magic Lantern Theater. It's an entirely different film in 1972 than it was in 1935. Just as a royal psalm like Psalm 23 is a different psalm in the time of the divided kingdom and say in terms of the Persian Empire, or the New Testament for that matter. So the film's appeal depends upon a historical context. For example, Woodstock appeals to one nation, one generation, and the graduate to another. If you even use the word graduate today, you see, is really an appeal to a past that is past and not present. Separate Teeth is one of these remarkable things. It's a truly adult film. It's a film about a man 25 years afterwards perceiving the meaning of his adolescence. And the young people last night had real difficulty with this. But for those of us who have a historical recital beyond adolescence, because of our historical recital, we buy into the film, we accept the its conditions of existence in an entirely different way. And if we can share the common historical recital, we will accept, we will suspend we will have the willing suspension of disbelief, as a drama critic would say. We will accept the limits of existence, the stipulations of existence, as portrayed by the film, if it corresponds to the way we recite history. If it does not correspond to the way we recite history, we will then not respond to it. So that, as I said about the cash outlay, we will really raise questions, is it worth it? And these same people who, after about 15 or 20 minutes of the film, leave angrily because they spent the money, and they know that in trying to get it back, they're rich before they start. Or, as we become involved, as most people do say with a film such as Deliverance, we say, yes, this is the way it is. And this is what it means to be human. These are the limits that are laid down for my existence. And it may be the afterglow of Christina or Lazarus. If we buy into it in this way and accept the stipulations, then there will be a going on the cosmic record, the covenant witnesses, that the structure of reality testifies to this statement of faith that we have participated in. So the film is a statement of faith. It's a description of value, of meaning, of significance. And we will also go on the human record, the covenant deposit, by some kind of response, which may take the form of a gasp, of laughter, or applause, or word-of-mouth advertising, or of ingestion of it in such a way that we communicate it in various other ways. We will also perceive in it blessings and curses which are appropriate to the historical recital. So if the film ends happily where it should be tragic, we will institute logical proceedings against the film and say, look, this isn't the way it is. Or if the film is tragic where it should be resolved in the form of a comedy, we will institute proceedings here in dialogue or argument with the film. In other words, we'll no longer be able to suspend disbelief, or we'll no longer be able to buy into the picture. That is, the film gives the director's cosmos, and the resolution of the film is his indication of where blessing and curse, where reward and penalty, where fulfillment and frustration lies in life. And if we buy into the director's understanding of life, we will accept the blessings and curses that the film proposes to us. If our historical recital of our own destiny does not correspond to this, we will reject it. For example, Separate Chief is faithful to the novel by John Knowles and to the director in talking about how peace is separate and life is characterized by alienation. It is not faithful to the Christian tradition that this is how salvation is gained, by going it alone. And so you have where you buy into and accept the covenant on the terms laid down by the novel and by the director. But where, as a Christian, you take issue with it, and on the basis of your historical recital, construct a different picture. But in either case, the typology of the covenant is involved in the experiencing of a film. I hope that comes through. Fourth, the issue of cosmology. I don't know really how to develop it, and even so, there's no time to do it. My own feeling is that the conventional narrative of Western literature, which has a beginning, a development, and an end, it has a complication which calls for some kind of deliverer to resolve, that the cosmic order is disturbed, that the deliverer comes and restores the cosmic order, and then there is some kind of fulfillment and realize a pathology, if you wish. But this way of telling a story is characteristically Western, characteristically Judeo-Christian. It's the kind of pattern that one sees there in Deuteronomy 26, from a wandering Aramean to the promised land. The Hexateuch is, as a whole, the kind of pattern thinking one sees in the Gospels, whether the Gospels as a whole or in the healing stories of the Gospels. Let me give one example of this because of its complete inversion of content, but its typological fidelity. That is, another film several years back called Easy Rider. The film seems to me is not Christian, but it follows the typology of the Judeo-Christian cosmology. Easy Rider begins in the west near the Mexican border. Easy Rider means somebody who is making money on the basis of drugs. And so with money gained by the sale of drugs, the two Easy Riders set out. They're going east. It's an inverted exodus. That is, they're going, American tradition of the exodus is go west, young man. And they're going east. They're going to the Mardi Gras, which is an ambiguous symbol either of Lent and discipline and a preparation and an encounter, or in New Orleans, the Mardi Gras is a symbol of dissipation and revelry. They arrive there, and while in a brothel, you hear the word, the music of the mass done in acid rock. They go from there to sexual relations in a graveyard. On Ash Wednesday the next day, one says to the other, "We blew it." And a few moments later, the motorcycle is blown up in a destruction by fire, which I feel may have some relationship to Vietnam. That is, Easy Rider moves out of the flesh pots of Egypt, the drug culture, through the wilderness, the American Southwest, into the promised land of the Mardi Gras of New Orleans, only to blow it. And you get a prophetic indictment here, and to die meaninglessly. But the pattern by which the story is told seems to me comes out of the salvation tales of either testament. And this is the reason why you tell it this way rather than in another way. It seems to me that there are at least two others, models, and probably you could suggest others for me. One of them is the model of Greek cosmology, which the only example I think of offhand is of a film called The Other, which deals with motiveless evil at work in the universe. And the other would be the existential, the now dimension, which only the present moment is valid. In fact, to me, stranger picture. This is not the vote. The hypothesis that I'm working on is that biblical faith and the human situation of the Christian can really be summarized under five myths, with an extra one that I, again, don't quite know what to do with it. It's a hypothesis that of a way of drawing together all experience by the Christian. Mythic because the experiences are typological or representational in nature. That is, the experiences in a myth are descriptions of as it was, it is now, and evermore shall be. And I propose the five following myths, which you can follow either from Genesis to Revelation. Primordial creation, which is Eliade's phrase. The loss of innocence, that is, the knowing of good and evil. The hero as savior, and I'm thankful to Campbell for the phrase hero, which gets us out of this rather meaningless double talk for me of Christ figures. It seems to me all as muddies the waters. Fourth, realized eschatology, which is perhaps another way of saying it, is the relationship of fulfillment of the promise, in which you have the restoration of primordial order as a result of the hero's faith and action. And five, consummation. I find myself fuzzy in looking at films or looking at life in general, how you distinguish between realized eschatology and consummation, between the reality that comes into being with the Christ event in the New Testament and the city of God, the New Jerusalem, as seen in the book of Revelation. And I've not been able to work out the tension of these two, because in films, they seem to me to come together, fairly close together, and do not divide themselves easily. The plus one with the myth is the myth that anthropologists call the trickster. The trickster because in talking about the disturbing of order, there's frequently a characteristic of wit or play or fancy, as well as of the demonic, the destructive, and the anti-Christ kind of motif. I don't know where to place the myth of the trickster, the imposer of order, the devil, and so on. I don't know where to place this in relationship to the other five. And if you have suggestions, fine by me. Well, in terms of these five myths, the basic mythic patterns in film, they are sometimes stated explicitly and sometimes stated implicitly. For example, in primordial creation, that is, the perception of things as they are in the beginning at any given moment. At the Eucharist, for example, when the Eucharist is presented, at that moment, this is my body. As it was, it is now, and evermore shall be. And we are taken into the primordial moment of the firstness, the creation of a new being. In terms of explicit symbols, there was a film last year called Walkabout, which you may have seen, where a young Australian girl and her small brother are placed in the center of the Australian wilderness, and there they meet a young Aboriginal that you may have seen in tonight's show and elsewhere. They are in the heart of the desert, and when night comes, they lie down under a bush. People sometimes ask, "Well, you didn't step into it." But the bush has a very bright fruit on it, and there's a green snake that twines itself around. You may not be aware of it unless you're looking for it rather carefully. A little bit obvious symbol. Later on, they are walking along a winding path surrounded by green, lush vegetation, and there are all kinds of brightly colored birds and stamping animals in the underground. It sounds very much like the American painter's paintings of the Peaceable Kingdom. There's a sequence at a tree, what is an enormous tree, bare of bark, which looks like the intertwined limbs of bodies. Almost Rodin-like. Later on, the Aborigine and the girl play in this tree. She hanging self unselfconsciously down with her dress falling down, just like children, complete naivete, complete lack of knowing good and evil. So if you supply evil to the situation, you have to come with the kind of Victorian upbringing that I had. But it's pretty hard to find it out of the situation itself. A scene in the rock pool where the three naked go swimming together. No awareness that they are naked. It appears to me that the director is saying here that there is a quality of innocence, a quality of unknowingness that has a direct correspondence with the Old Testament myth of Genesis 3. And he is deliberately shaping his visual imagery to be evocations of Genesis 3. And if the points of resemblance here are too close to be accidental, at this point it seems to have an explicit retelling of aspects of the Genesis myth in this particular film, Walkabout. It's more common that it would be implicit. For example, in the film Billy Jack, who is a half-breed Indian, he's a kind of a guardian angel for an Indian school, which is taught by a woman. An Indian school is very much, again, like the garden. An Indian school has three rules. No sex, no drugs, and each one do your own thing. Sounds very much to me like the garden, or like flower people. Though against this, there is the town, which is very critical of all the goings-on up at the school. And in various ways, tries to get money from the school, tries to get it out of existence, and so on. In other words, that there are two ways of life between the unfallen community and the fallen community of civilization. I think it fits fairly well with understanding the Yahwist in Genesis 3:11, talking about the rise of civilization and the alienations which accompany it. My feeling would be that to talk about the garden and about the Cain-Abel tension between the two is to impose a frame of reference of my own upon the film. But to talk about the film saying this implicitly seems to me to have merit, And in fact, if I really want people to understand what we're really getting at in Genesis 3 and 4, one of the easiest ways for them to appropriate this meaning is by way of seeing a film such as Billy Jack, rather than by giving them a lecture. There's a number of other examples of this implicit. Creation is also handled biblically as a conflict between chaos and order. And I think what I was saying about the film The Ruling Class, in which Jack, the Earl of Gurney, is seen as a manifestation of Jesus Christ, claiming Godhead. He's clothed in white, he proclaims love, he is a natural man. As over against when he becomes God in the form of Jack the Ripper, he becomes then the God of black clothed in black, like the hangman, the God of repression, the God who administers death and who is surrounded by death. But here is a real conflict between chaos and order, in which chaos is seen as a greater kind of order than order, and order is seen as a kind of chaos. It really takes you into the tensions of gospel and law in the New Testament. Another example of the conflict between chaos and order seems to me takes place in The Godfather, in which remember the film opens with a black screen and about 30 seconds of blackness before then the white titles come on. But in The Godfather, the dark scenes are always where business is going on, and the business, of course, is the business of the mafia. Whereas the light scenes are always the scenes of the family, or the lovely romantic interlude in Sicily. There is a tension here between death and life, and the opening sentence of the film is a figure in darkness saying to another figure in darkness, "I believe in America." And I think you could go on to say that the film is about how do you achieve salvation in American culture. But that goes beyond it. But this whole interplay between chaos and order, of darkness and light, which is found in The Godfather. The Loss of Innocence is where there are the most examples of film, partially because this is simply characteristic of the American consciousness. Some of you may know Lewis's book, The American Adam. But in Separate Peace, where the rite of passage into manhood is to climb a dominant tree, go out on the branch, and plunge into the river, and dive into the river, you've got already all kinds of things. You've got a cosmic tree, you've got a watery abyss, you've got passing from childhood into manhood, the test of courage, and so on. You've dealing with a lot of things in the history of religion and anthropology. But when it takes place, below the level of willing or consciousness, or the articulation of the subconscious will, where the tree is shaken in such a way so that the valedictorian follower causes the athletic leader to fall on his back to the ground. You are dealing very literally with the fall. And when I was with a group of people discussing the film, this is how they talked about it, not knowing they were using traditional language. It is a time when in a world at war, in a private school, away from the world, where you really are quite innocent, where you play games like blitzball, in which there are no allies, and this sort of is a game. But at this moment, you come against the inescapable fact that you now know that there is something evil in the world with which you have to cope. And innocence is lost. I think if you carry it through, that it's not only the tree of knowing good and evil, it's the tree of life and death. For ultimately, sinner who falls from the tree will die. And ultimately, Gene, who is responsible for his falling, will live, but he will die. One of the last words you use is you don't cry at your own funeral. He will die, and yet Finney will live in him, which is the way I think to view the dialogue with the doctor at the end of the film. The point being that the tree serves not only the two trees, not only the tree of knowing good and evil, but the tree of life and death. And of course, if by this tree life comes into the world, and you've got a strong crossbar motif in the film, in the tree, and the tree really dominates, the image of the tree dominates the entire picture from beginning to end, you have some cross atonement salvation symbols operating as well. But here, innocence is lost. There's a film called Taking Off, a sex film, in which is a story basically of the lifestyles that vary between generations. But the child has gone away and stopped the moral values of the parents, and they are distraught and desperate by it. And then they find kinds of satisfactions in the hunting for the lost daughter, a kind of vicarious enjoyment. They pick up some new friends who have lost their child as well, and they end up in the living room in the house in their home, drunken and playing a game of strip poker. About which point, this is when the husband is stripped completely and stands on the card table and is drunkenly dancing around, in comes a teenage daughter ready for reconciliation. At this point, you see, you have a complete denudation, and he knew that he was naked. And the counterpoint of the metaphor and of the reality of the loss of something that can never be recaptured. And then the film goes out and what's the relationship from there. Or, I continue almost indefinitely with that. And third, the hero, rather than the Christ figure, convention for this, of course, is the mystery novel where the detective is the savior, or the western. Let me take Billy Jack, because the role of Billy Jack, the half-breed Indian, the guardian angel of the school, is a good example of Christ syncretism. For example, Billy Jack first appears in the film mounted on a horse in the underbrush. And you see the trees moving, and then gradually you see the shape of the rider astride the horse revealed. This is an almost exact replica of Deere's engraving of the night. You know this one? And it tells you quite clearly that Billy Jackson is going to be the cavalier, the chivalrous one, who watches over the destiny of the school. The second day, he is a... he's in the cowboy Indian tradition, he's a half-breed, which kind of puts him between the two. He's characterized as a strong, silent man of action. And strong, silent men of action in the American frontier tradition stand outside the law. He's beyond good and evil. And so he operates regardless of the law, administrating his private justice, beating up a man, ridiculing a man, or whatever it may happen to be. In a sense, he is a Freudian figure in that he represents the active male as over against the headmistress of the school, who takes issue with him because he counsels love and nonviolent resistance. And part of the real tension, she ends up being raped consequently. And part of the tension of the film is the tension between how are you going to oppose the invasion of the village upon the school by aggressive action or by passive love. And he puts the Freudian opposites here in the male and female principles. Fourth, it's a Marxist Christ in which the Christ figure acts against the oppressor and who has no supernatural cosmology. You may know a painting such as Orozco's, where he shows the cross being chopped down by a vigorous, virile Christ, with the black cloaked clergy in the back cowering away and a proletariat advancing. And you may know a Max Beckmann drawing of Christ before Pilate, in which you see the Christ with his thorns and Pilate with the face of Mussolini, and you know who's going to be the victor. It's going to be the proletariat, not Mussolini. And so you have here the Marxist Christ. Or you have the Christ with a passion. One point where he is going through an initiation rite into the tribe involving serpents, and he lifts up the serpent just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, and an assassin lines him up in the the sight of a rifle, and you see him spread out with a serpent, you don't have to be too smart. I'm not talking about whether it's good art or not. But he had a sight there. He's beaten up by the mob, despised and rejected. The little children cluster around him. He is taken in a chapel, and he comes out before the sheriff with the exact motions and arrangement of characters like the Christ before Pilate in the Hoffman painting. And he makes a triumphal exit, not entry, with the children lined up to see him go away, knowing that he will come again and be sure that the order that has been initiated by his sacrifice will be reintroduced. My point is, first of all, here is an explicit Christ image, but it is a syncretistic image in which at least four other cultural strands are operating, and you have to use tradition criticism here just as much as you do anywhere else. Realized eschatology is when the crisis has been passed and some form of reconciliation or order is imposed, however severe, however blessed. For example, in Truffaut's The Wild Child, this child that was a child of nature, contemporary to this show, who is discovered by villagers and who is brought to for scientific observation and finally placed with a doctor as his tutor, goes through the innocence of creation to learning that there is something good, there is something bad, to learning violence of hand raised against one another, through the engulfing of passions and storms of emotion, raising the question at the end that in this healthy relationship of tutor and child, in losing his innocence, has he gained a fulfillment of order? What lies before him, the Tower of Babel or fulfillment? And the future is open. In Bergman's Through a Glass Darkly, the order is restored in terms of love has come into being as a result of a sacrifice. In Silence, the estrangement still exists, but moving towards consummation, there is still the promise of a church. So you can take the films then and go beyond that where the visual images stop. If you extrapolate, what do you anticipate? And you move out of what is realized within the context of a film to what you can expect to come in consummation. It's revealing to take a film like Z, Zoe He Lives, with its ambiguous ending, in which all the order seems to be destroyed, except that you have affirmed he lives, and you have a vision of eschatology yet to come. And compare with the French Connection, which uses the same ending visually as Z does, except to say it's all hopeless, and all you can do is go shortly forward. And it seems to me that you have some the expectations that are affirmed or denied in those two films. There are some apocalyptic images, such as the film Blow Up, a late title, or the Bristol Point, where you see a house blown up in 10 different times. There's some real consummation in a film such as 2001, Space Odyssey, where the final image on the screen is that of rebirth. These are the five basic myths, and it seems to me that one is working with a statement of experience, in this case a film, that it comes rather naturally to use these myths or patterns of expression. In conclusion, what have I been trying to do? I've said that I stated an interest that comes out of my own biography and my own needs, which I seem to find coming out of the needs of the people with whom I'm in contact or to whom I minister, and that film is one area in which to develop this kind of ministry. Went on to say that there seems to be some significant ways by which specific images of the Bible and specific images of films may be interrelated. But it makes sense to me to talk about a cultic experience of presence that is mediated by a film. And it makes sense to me to talk about a cultic experience of covenant that is mediated by a film. I think one can talk about cosmology meaningfully, as I did with Easy Rider, although that was left undeveloped. But there seem to me to be five basic myths: creation, fall, salvation, realized eschatology, or promise and fulfillment, and consummation. And there's a picture lies outside this. That these five basic myths seem to me are presented in films both explicitly and implicitly, and learning how to read them enables me better to read my biblical faith. The legitimate question then might be, so what? I think the aim that I have in this kind of endeavor is to bring both the Bible and the secular into life situations. For a person like me who is overexposed to the tradition, who is accustomed to head tripping, who is too busy, the film enables me to dialogue with my tradition. I find that if I'm working with people like high school sophomores, that they're beginning to really being able to take evil seriously, or alienation, and to talk about life and death, mind and body, and dying for others. That I've been working with my students, that I can overcome the professor-student gap in the way in which I reject the film that they accept, for example, The Last Picture Show, or that I can call them on their head-tripping about religion and make them get it down into life situations. And if I'm working with adults in a film such as The Ruling Class, which we discussed Friday night, the group there were really staggered by the word innocent. I had to think through what it means to talk about innocence and the fall, and to their surprise found it was meaningful. Or to talk about Christ crucified as a stumbling block, or about the reality of evil, or the death and lifestyles and the life and death style, and so on. As if communication is a crucial issue, film presents a powerful medium for communication of the faith. That's it.
I'm not quite sure, again, what you find communicating. I'm not sure when you begin talking about general patterns of human existence, exactly how you see that connected with Jesus Christ. Many of the experiences that you talk about, they seem not something that you have in Hinduism, or a number of other non-Christian religious experiences. Now, I'm just kind of thinking in my mind, the specific focus that you see between these things in film and Jesus Christ is different from the individual rather than throughout the life of man.
I guess the purpose of what I'm doing is to open up the door to communicate with the language and the symbols of the tradition with people who have written them off, or with people who have made them into idols and have lost the relational aspect, which is what faith is all about. That's what I think is what I'm about then, is sharpening a ministry of communication of the faith. In terms of where I am in respect to Christ, I find that I have real impotence in the area of faith, that I'm not able to believe that which I do not believe. And that I have no resources of will, no potency to make me believe what I do not believe. And my problem was that I found that I could no longer use faith language like God is love, or God so loved, or God delivered Israel out of Egypt. I could use this as object language, that this is a faith, this is a tradition, the Bible says. But I found that for myself, it had lost its vitality and its saving power. And what I had to do in my own autobiography, the first breakthrough was really that experience with the film Aventura, where I really found myself being empowered to love when I found myself unlovable and unloving and paralyzed by it. And my problem simply is that I've known the language so long that at that point in my existence it had no cutting edge to say. I found myself then going in the direction, say, of Eliade, and discovering that even when I thought I wasn't being religious, I was, in a book such as Sacred and Profane. I'm finding real help in what he says about myth and history, and comparing this with what Erickson says about identity with trust and autonomy, and seeing the area of trust as being the area of myth, and the area of autonomy as being the area of history, and that as the self and its identity bring together its ability to trust the rhythm of life and yet have autonomy, so in faith, the tradition, or in faith, my own experience, I could begin to do this. And then began to work with Campbell and begin to find that here also, that whether or not I said I believed it or not made very little difference. This is the way I was going to perceive reality. And therefore, in order to be who I was, I had to express myself in the myth pattern. And the result was then that all of a sudden I found these things just simply bouncing at life. And instead of finding a biblical faith in my Bible all the time, I began to find it wherever I went in the world. I think a lot about it.
This is my question. It sounds also like a personal philosophy and something that organizes existence to be personally. So I'm not quite sure if Jesus Christ is a person as opposed to, say, a word in the sense of feeling or a word of organizing the world. How does Jesus Christ as a person fit into
this world? I think that happened to him. That's the center. I can see this now. I could verbalize it before, but I just simply didn't live by it. It had no gut level. I'm thinking a little bit on that. I think what I was trying to suggest was a typological understanding of reality. Whether I like it or not, these are the patterns of escape that reality has for the person stands in the biblical tradition. And I believe also when you say about Hinduism, to a certain extent, it's what it means to be human. But it seems to me there's a distinctive content as well as a general content in the myth, in the Christian appearance of the myth. I didn't try to, I was really talking about their existence, their reality, that modern man can understand this if you can participate in his experience when you reveal them. Now, if you ask me to evaluate the myth and say, is the Lord Christ at the center of it? I think that's a different kind of question. I think I'm bonding this and say, yes, the Lord Christ is at the center. But that's a faith statement. And I think the myths are demonstrative statements. As what I've tried to do is to describe films in terms of what is there and the way it corresponds to what is in biblical faith. And that's not an absolute there because the films are a product of the Judeo-Christian culture which shapes its values in that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but when you say it that way, it seems essentially that you're kind of, it sounds as though you're kind of minimizing it. And essentially these are the questions of life. And once we can get people raising these questions about life, then they can place answers in relationship to one another and buy into the answer which is the most powerful. And at this point, Christian communication becomes relatively simple. Am I hearing that? Complex, because not only is the Christian tradition secularized in our film, but the Japanese traditions are westernized in their film. But because of the Western market, some of you would be far better at Christian than I could possibly do. Woman in the Dunes. Woman in the Dunes is a good example. And it would never happen that way in an American film. Where the fellow comes and is down in the pit of the sand dunes and is there, and there you have to come to grips with the elemental reality of sand and water and womanness and childness. And he discovers his existence by this confined space at the bottom of the dunes. And friends tell me that this is very similar, especially the relationship with water, to some of the patterns of them.
Thank you.
very interesting that you can get a background in a Christian faith background in a Christian message. That's very kind of correlation from the Nazi Muslim background. But when you realize that if you're a philosopher, structure that one entirely on Christian thought, it suddenly changes the entire into a deity. So that in the beginning of the film, this man who's going to die of cancer begins to look for a state somewhere else in the world. And the city is accompanied by dogs who swing around him and who appears in typically mythical background, takes him through these various guys and leads him to a modern type figure, and he has an important relationship with her. So it's structured entirely on Jesus' power. And in this man proceeds to various attempts to satisfy himself and attain complete satisfaction until he finally makes his program. As you remember, father at the end of his life reclaiming money. And then he has the father to see him, which is in heaven, and there's a debate as to whether father can be saved. And his correspondence to the Hebrew, where he has to live. And the people are sitting around discussing the individual mission of Mobutu or Wabutu or something like that, and they're discussing whether he should be saved. And there's only one figure in that way who gives exactly the reason what that the angel did for why Paul should be saved. Namely that his last effort was an unselfish one. But the rest of the people condemn him, just as the rest of the human court condemns Paul. And then a person with a Christian background doesn't realize that this movie was constructed point by point upon the German romantic ideal, it's going to come away with certain other ideas. But I think, therefore, that the position that what is in the film, whether it's very substantive to the consciousness, is extremely important to the speaker.
Mm-hmm.
So, along that line, I'd also say that if you look at modern tradition, you see a re-emergence of a interest in oral tradition. And this is the film that I'm representative of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in biblical times, this oral tradition is also a dominant world. It's not through print, which is characterized our culture. But the mode in which the Bible was composed was the same mode in which films are composed. So that's an example of filmmakers. He'll take a scene and they can sing elements he doesn't want. But he doesn't cut the scene up into little bits and just keep the things he wants. What he does is he juxtaposes one thing to the next on the one fundamental principle of editing, which is that follow focus must be maintained. So that scene A ends at a certain center of focus and scene B picks up at that point. And the Bible is edited in exactly the same way. That compiled scene, which contains elements which the editor may not necessarily want, are put next to each other in such a way that the composed elements will make comments back and forth and readjust and correct what seems to be contradictory motifs. So what I'm saying is that when you read a version of all of the different scene and film, you have an exact duplication of the moment of oral tradition and composition of the
body.
So our question is pertaining to how much you can see in a film driven by the structure.
Thank you, Father Robert. If I can just one comment, I would not want what I have done to be perceived as being head-tripping, because I agree completely that the more you analyze what's going into a film, the more there is to be seen. And it seems to me that we are always caught in the arts as we are in faith, which are the dilemma of the professional and the amateur. And how do we basically think of the arts on experience? And how do we preserve simultaneously the experience of the amateur, the direct apprehension of reality as mediated by the artistic event? And at the same time, how do we maintain our intellectual, our rational integrity and responsibility for responding as whole as possible to what is there? Last couple of speakers, you know, I'm going to start a whole new program on it, and might be a very interesting program. You want to thank our two people who responded to our request for help on the program, each in his own way, I think, gave us a paper that's different, started a lot of discussion that would have continued longer if somebody else hadn't stood up and said, kind of be quiet now. they were laughing, especially, I think it was a kind of a new paper for the St. Louis Biblical Studies Society, and maybe it's Dr. Juicy's running and somebody else for next spring that will help the program community out.